This is like an expensive, hard, and long-earned self-awareness about this one very specific part of my brain. Let me be clear. Also, it's worth bearing in mind, perfectionists are very good at getting well, not as good at staying well, because we rush to be well and then it all falls apart.
You are listening to Made of Human, also known as the Mopod, a podcast hosted by Sophie Hagen, who is a Danish comedian.
Mopod.
Trying to find out
Mopod.
How to do life.
Mopod.
But it turns out
Mopod.
Nobody knows
Mopod.
I am talking to you at 10 p.m. on a Thursday evening. The garden doors open and I am freezing all the way into the core of my soul, but my wonderful dog Hank is outside, hopefully peeing, hopefully doing more than that, and I need to record this and go to sleep. So, hello. That is the context from which I'm speaking to you. This conversation that I had with Catherine Bohard was recorded on November 21st, 2020, over Zoom. For some more context, Joe Biden was elected president not too long ago in the US, but at this point no one still really knows if Trump will allow this. There is a global pandemic and London is in lockdown, although we are hearing rumors of a vaccine. That is the global context. Catherine Bohard, like me, lost all live work 8 months ago. She is an Irish queer comedian living in London, and she talks openly about her OCD and body dysmorphia on stage. I almost cancelled 15 minutes before the conversation because I had so much anxiety for absolutely no reason. And because I knew that Catherine would understand this, I actually wanted to speak to her. So I got myself in the shower and I put on a Christmas reindeer onesie and I set up my brand new microphone. I asked Catherine to wait 5 minutes just so I could brush my teeth because I felt a bit gross. And of course, when we started the conversation, I hoped that she would ignore that in the background she could see my dirty kitchen and the open garden door, and she would be able to hear the loud neighbors and, of course, my dog. Please enjoy my conversation with the incredible Catherine Bohard.
I am in my spare room slash office. I have my Christmas tree behind me because I'm borrowing it from friends who are moving house. So they have a 7-foot fake tree. I would usually prefer a real one, but you're also meeting me in a pandemic. So I don't have much money. So I was like, I'll take your spare tree. Yes, please. I've been to the Chelsea Farmers Market. That's not near where I live, but I walked because they have the most incredible flatbreads. That makes it sound like a thing I do often. It's not, but my neighbor volunteers there, so I went. And you are meeting me on a, I guess, tired, slightly insecure day, but one where I'm grateful to talk to somebody else because I felt like, oh, I came back from being out with my neighbors and I was like, oh, my house is quiet. And the week was busy in ways that were largely unresolved. I love getting stuff done. I hate tasks that cannot be immediately completed. Ongoing anything gives me major stress. And also a week in which, I don't know, you probably know this, but my world, I guess, is like a pandemic, trying to make a living without a job. Trying to be a cam clown as best I can in the meantime.
To be a what?
A cam clown.
Like, what is that?
This is what I call being a comedian online.
Oh.
and also, what, like six or seven weeks ago, my 5-year relationship ended.
Oh.
So my world is not bad, just very much in transition, which is not a necessarily always a comfortable place to sit.
Did you feel like
that answers the question?
It does. Did you feel like you're in a transitional period even before it ended?
Well, I felt like I was in a limbo. So in a way, the breakup actually put like some sort of forward impetus on the limbo. No, I think I felt like static beforehand, and there's no point in pretending that, like, even with like the bad sides, something happening was still kind of thrilling this year, which, even if it was a bad thing, that sounds bad, but it's true, something, it felt like a propelling, at least. If maybe I didn't want to go forward in that direction, but here I am, and at least it's something different. Something, yeah, different from the plague. Hey.
It feels like it's the worst thing in the world is when people say this to you, isn't it? But how much of an opportunity something like that can be.
Yeah.
You know, it can push you towards something. It can also destroy you forever, and you never trust anyone again, and you'll never love again. But also, if you're not that broken, it can also rebuild you.
Yeah, I think also, like, I think I sell myself often. My brand can be a bit, like, nihilistic cynic. But when it comes to romance, I'm actually a bit of a melt. Like, I'm a bit of, like, I surprise myself by how optimistic I am about it every time. So I don't know where that comes from. But I think, yeah, I think it can be a good thing. I also think people keep saying to me, like, oh, it's such a horrible time to be broken up with. And I have to say that I disagree, because I would never have thought about it or processed it in the way that I am. And I would never have had to sit with myself, had some like actual time alone and been comfortable with it. And also, I would have probably made some mistakes I shouldn't have. And I certainly would have ended up doing something which I hate doing. When I'm in a bad way, sometimes I'll like overbook myself, because I don't think like being like, you know, mom, my heart's broken, go to work. But then I'll go to work and not be able to go to work. And then I would have been in a shame spiral about canceling work too. So actually, it's kind of given me permission to actually feel my feelings.
Sounds, yeah. I mean, you say feel your feelings, and I go, oh, that sounds uncomfortable.
Oh no, grim, horrible, yes, but important. And actually, who'd have thunk it? Actually quite helpful. Although, yes, very uncomfortable.
How does it affect your OCD?
I think because OCD is a coping mechanism, amongst other things, a learned behavior in times of crisis and change. Yeah. So like, as soon as it happened, I had to sit down with myself and have a word and be like, okay, your brain is going to want to control for the uncontrollable, fix what, you know, it can, and busy itself so that it doesn't have to engage with this. So we're going to have to be on the lookout for that. And I've tried to be. But also, there are some like things where it's kind of like a tricky balance, because on the one hand, now when I tidy, my house stays tidy. So I don't have to clean so much. So you could be like, ooh, that's good, you're not engaging with the OCD. But also, I do relish that it stays exactly as I left it. And so it's kind of a hard one to balance. I definitely want to talk to... It definitely made me be like, I got to check in with a therapist to make sure that I... Because when change happens, it almost always does affect my OCD. And it's definitely affected the BDD side of the OCD. And the
BDD?
So my OCD is perfectionism. It's around symmetry and order. And that often goes hand in hand with BDD. So body dysmorphic disorder. Yeah. Little bit of extra on the side, little bonus prize. And I definitely have noticed that. And I think some parts of this, it's not necessarily BDD. It's just trying to figure out which one's which. Like, because I think sometimes when you have heartache, it's just hard to eat. That's just not usual for me. So, and then I could hear a little part of my brain going, good, you're not hungry. Good. And it's like, well, that's fucked. And you know that's fucked. So where is that? What's that about? And then, I mean, I'm really getting into it. And then that was definitely like, oh, you feel old and unattractive and alone, so you're punishing yourself to be like preemptively on the presumption that nobody will want you. What fun cycle. So I definitely am self-aware with it, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and it doesn't mean that I don't have to be like actively working to not let it take hold.
It sounds like you've... we'll ignore that. The dog won't ignore that.
Is it a delivery?
Yeah, I know. He's like...
Is it a delivery man?
Yeah, but they'll just leave it outside as they're meant to, as I've told them to. It's just a shovel to pick up the shit outside.
Oh, no.
Just my shit shovel.
Oh my god!
Context.
Shovel is a great context. I swear to God, I feel like you've just summed up everything I've just said. Yes, wonderful. I need a shit shovel. Great.
He's all like, "This is not the usual." Okay, so what? I don't know how to phrase it so it doesn't sound like condescending. I just think it's rare that people have that much of a handle on their coping mechanisms that, you know, it's, even though I, you know, therapy for 15 years and I know every single thing my brain does all the time, I still find myself going, oh, stop it. I know. Shh, it's okay. He needs to leave it outside. Yeah, he'll leave it outside. It's okay. Yeah, I know. It's okay.
Oh, I want to watch your like buddy cop duo. I love you guys together.
Yeah, come up, say hi. Hi.
Hi. Are you wearing a jumper?
He's wearing a jumper.
He's wearing a yellow jumper. I die. Oh my god, the pair of you together.
Oh,
that's so Catherine. Cute. Hi.
Catherine has a firm hold on her OCD.
He's like, I don't really care. I genuinely think you all need to just chill out. How about that? I'm gonna go stand in the garden. I don't think that's condescending. I think that's nice.
Well, where did it start? Do you remember the? Because surely it started with you not knowing what it was, right? The yoosh.
Oh, this is like an expensive, hard and long earned self-awareness about this one very specific part of my brain. Let me be clear. There's a shitload of other stuff I need to work on too, and also like it didn't come from nowhere. So like, yeah, I was diagnosed when I was 22. But before that, it was real bad. Like, I definitely have very, very, very early memories of things that I can now identify as OCD. So,
how early?
Like, primary school? Like, I used to talk about this in my show, but like we had cousins come to stay when we were kids, and like I had to give up my room and I would just take a pencil and draw a pencil line around every single thing in and out of cupboards, drawers, so that I would know if anything was marginally moved, and then I could go back and rub it out and dust everything down again. So like not a chill kid. And I had dolls that I never took out of their boxes because they were for dusting, and I had genuine and abject rage if somebody opened my curtains or made my bed for me because I did those things the right way, and I would be in mourning if I didn't, and if they did it for me, and I couldn't word why those things were devastating. And I was like in secondary school utterly brutally hard on myself about like my body and my academics, and but also like couldn't cope with the books that they gave us because they were all over the shop in terms of colors and fonts and had like fun animations. So I'd be like, I need to rewrite these all out in black and white in my own notebook so I can read them in class. So I wasn't like a chill gal. And when they when I got to university, it was I don't know if you've ever had this, but sometimes I think with like debilitating mental illness, and it had become that in university. Forgive me if I'm boring you or if I'm answering too long.
No, this is perfect.
Okay, well, I feel like sometimes there's this like, there are moments where you pop your head above the water when you're drowning, where you have like a tiny window to ask for help. And it feels like if you don't, you'll go back under kind of thing. So near the end of university, I wasn't eating enough at all. And I said to my mom, that was the thing I could verbalize. I couldn't really put words to the rest. So I sort of said to mom, like, I'm not able to eat. And I care too much about weight loss. And that was as much as I could word. But I had lost a lot of weight. So I think she was like, I'm really lucky. My mom works at a hospital. My mom had had access and the knowledge about who was the right person to talk to. And then I went to I'd been to like counselors and been on antidepressants and spoken to a few people, but it'd always been like, you're depressed. And then I spoke to this psychologist for several hours. And then he was like, I think this is evidently a part of a broader problem in terms of OCD. And, I want you to speak to this other specialist. So then I did. And then I was very quickly diagnosed at that point, which I feel really lucky about. But then when I finished uni, I did this is such a long answer.
No, please.
I did a hospital treatment program for OCD. And then I moved to London and they recommended a therapist here. So I feel like I've put in the work. Also, it's worth bearing in mind, perfectionists are very good at getting well, not as good at staying well, because we rush to be well and then it all falls apart. So I have had to really work on that. But I would say this, OCD almost, like, I think it almost killed me a few times, and it was really, 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 really bad. But I only am well and want to be well because I like my life. But maybe if I didn't, maybe I wouldn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
That too dark?
We're fine with dark.
Okay, fine. Dark. Okay, good.
It would be strange if you were too cheery about this, right?
Yeah. And so, like, it's so great because in many ways, even if I could choose, I would still have OCD. Not, so.
For people, I mean, I was about to say for people who don't have it, but even so, I mean, because I have it in another way, but even I can't answer this, but maybe you can. I feel like when we try to describe OCD, it's just, when I describe it, it's like, if this doesn't happen, It's like, I can't explain the sort of what the horrible thing that will happen is or how it feels when you can't change it.
Yeah.
But it's just like this has to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
What? Yeah. I guess, how would you describe what's like, the extreme of that? Like, how, one thing is knowing this thing has to happen, but then what?
I guess it's like, it is like utter and all consuming belief in, yes, an irrational fear, but one that presents as fundamental fact. But the ongoing day-to-day living of that, like hour-to-hour, to me, is like trying to sleep when your neighbors are playing really loud music. It's like, I'm trying, but like concentrating on anything else, relaxing in any way, being able to let yourself go anyway is impossible because it's fucking grating. Like, it's constant and it's loud and it feels so overwhelmingly, for me, like, it brings up a lot of anger. I guess that's maybe how I describe it. But also, like, you know, I think it's not unself-aware. Like, it's not like, so when I would walk into a room and I was very at my illest and I could not, like, it was hard for me to go out of my house because I wasn't in control of spaces outside of my own house. But in my own house, say when I had just cleaned like the day before, I would walk in and physically feel like the dust in the room was on my skin, feel like everything that was out of place was like a physical pain. But that sat hand in hand with knowing that that wasn't right. That's what I mean when I say it wasn't, it is self-aware. A lot of OCD people are like, say, for example, the one we know a lot of is like washing your hands. It's like, if they've been in the world or like spoken to a doctor, anyway, like most people know that like they're not supposed to do it 70 times a day, but that also sits beside, I have to do it, or a terrible thing will happen, or I'll feel like they need to rip my skin off. So I think people think you're just like the word crazy comes to mind, but actually it's a problematic word, but it's also like, yeah, I think it misses the nuance that you can simultaneously desperately need to do something in an overwhelming sense and also know that that's not what you're supposed to be doing, but one doesn't counteract the other unless you really work on it in OCD, because with OCD, the like best way of challenging that lie in your head that something bad will happen if you don't is by not doing it and then proving to your brain it doesn't. And then the impulse becomes less valid. But bloody hell, it's a lot harder to do than it is to say.
I had one of my weird OCD things that came a couple of months ago, 4 months ago, was this idea that the ceiling was going to collapse. And like, I always had to be very aware of everything because the ceiling was probably going to collapse. Mm-hmm. And I had this in my head for a while, trying to, do the whole thing of like, it's not though, how many ceilings collapse in the day to day? Like, of course. And then my upstairs neighbor opened their washing machine when it was still going, and water started coming down the ceiling. And no. I had this moment of, if the ceiling collapses, like, I will never get well again.
No, I'll be right. I'll have been right. No,
it's not OCD. I'm psychic. This is horrible. Yeah.
It's
a whole other
thing. It's like when people were like, at the pandemic, people were like, oh, you were right all along. And it's like, don't say that to people with OCD. Don't say that. No. That's a bad message. No. But yeah, I'm glad that your ceiling didn't collapse in. I'm sorry that the water leaked. And are you not living there anymore?
Oh yeah, no, I moved house, and I'm not saying that's the reason, but it happened around the same time. So.
You know what? I don't know what the professional opinion here is, but I'm just going to say, fine. I don't think it's supposed to rain inside. Fair.
Pretty sure.
Yeah, fair. It's fine.
Do you... Oh, there's so many questions. So first of all, when you are in a moment of, like, you know that it's not meant to be like this, but you're still having to do it, does shame come in?
Of course.
So you're also ashamed of the fact that you can't stop doing this thing, even though you know why and you know...
Yeah,
it becomes
of course.
This spiral.
I even have shame about the impulse. Like, sometimes I can stop myself at the impulse. A lot of the time I can stop myself at the impulse because I've practiced really hard to do that. And that's why I think I can function now. But I still have, like, shame that I can be, for example, I was in bed. And I thought to myself, oh, the cool thing about living alone is like you can just close the door on mess in the evening. And then it doesn't matter. You're not like setting a precedent for bad housemates. You're not going to affect anybody else's use of the space. You're how cool. Because that's what I wanted to think. And then like I couldn't sleep because the washing up wasn't done. And I could stop myself going in there, but I was like, you're 32 and you haven't been able to sleep if a wardrobe door was open or if there was something on the floor since as long as you can remember. And that like definitely started a shame spiral. Or like, I have shame. Here's the thing that I've been thinking about. I actually, do you mind if I ask you a question?
Of course, go on.
Okay. But I haven't had to tell anybody really about it in a while, like in any meaningful sense, because I've been with my ex-partner for 5 years, and the idea of having to like tell someone, and like it's bad because it's often the same conversation. They go, oh yeah, that's totally fine, and you're like, yeah, like you don't know what it is, and they'll be like, you know, like I've read about it, and you're like, and that makes me anxious and gives me some shame, because it's like you want to be sexy and fun and light, and you're like, it's coming for us all. So I don't know how you deal with that, or if you deal with that when you're talking to prospective love interests.
I think one of the the frustrating bit isn't necessarily the telling them, and it isn't necessarily their initial response. It is that thing when you realize that they thought you were exaggerating.
Oh yeah.
when you've said it, and you've written it down, you know exactly what words you've used to say exactly what is happening. You've given examples, you've sent articles, like you could not have been more clear about what this means. And they're like, I understand. Thank you for telling me. And then you realize, wait, did you not expect this to happen? And it's the frustration of, it almost feels like you're being gaslit because they're not, something in their brains go, well, it can't be that bad. And then that feels like a reflection of how bad it is.
Yes. And it also feels like a reflection of your inability to express it and their inability to listen, when actually they're probably like well-meaning. And I think the other problem is, like, a lot of the time when I talk about OCD and being well, I am currently well and have been well for a while, but well isn't like, it is therefore a thing that I'm talking about that was in my distant past. It's like, well is choosing not to do something 500 times a day, for which I'm very proud of myself.
Yeah.
But it's still like, I still walk into certain spaces and go, okay, that's going to be a lot more decisions than you, right there. That's going to be, you know, I think that's a hard thing to express.
I don't think I could ever be with anyone who didn't understand how valuable self-awareness is, especially when you're socialized, you know, been raised as a woman and you've been told so much that, oh, bitches be crazy. You know, it's such a, you know, being high strung or whatever it's called is such a, you know, being hysterical, all these gender terms that that is connected to women being too much or too demanding. So I always try to sort of sell myself on the awareness, like, yes, I will do all these things that will to you seem absolutely out of this world wild, but at least I know it, so I can tell you I'm about to do this, I'm doing this, and I know why, and I also know what to do. So you must understand that I can tell you what you need to do now.
But I'm still like a cool gal.
Like, I'm so clever that I know it. Can you just admire that? Like, at least I know it. So I need to have someone who can say, oh, yes, I understand you are being whatever OCD or depressed or anxious or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I know that you also know that. So I'm sort of talking to the awareness instead of the illness.
But yes, absolutely. I do also think, though, that, like, flip side, we're very hard to be with. And I say that because it's sort of a catch-22 with us sometimes, right? It's like, either you, like, for example, with me, you have two choices in that if you're in bed at that time, right? It's like, come on, we'll go clean the kitchen so you can sleep, which is absolutely facilitating the OCD, but is also a kindness in that exact moment and does let me go to sleep. Or you're like, you have to sit with this, I'm going to sleep. Now, technically, actually the much better thing to do, the correct thing to do, but, like, good fucking luck if you try it, like, in that moment. So I think we're hard, like, we're hard, you know. And
what about the options to just say, oh, just ignore it?
Oh, that is not, sorry. That option involves getting out of my bed and going back to your own.
Just cheer up, you know, just relax a bit, chill.
Why don't you just put on the Headspace app? So I think it's tricky. I think we are hard to, and we're like, oh, it's very easy to be like, we're so self-aware right now. And I am mostly, but like I say, it's still an ongoing, constant effort. Some days are harder.
Do you feel like with your specific, this comes from me having gotten into this rabbit hole of looking at interior design Facebook groups, one for maximalism, which is a bunch of stuff, bunch of colors, and then one for minimalism, which is like, own nothing. And there are sort of two extremes in each group. And it's almost like most people have like a good handle on it. But then there are definitely people in the maximalism group where it borders on hoarding.
Yeah.
And hovering is something we look down on, right? That's not like obviously not you and me, and it shouldn't be because it's an illness or a disorder. But
you know, hoarding is a type of OCD.
That's what. Yeah. That. Well, yeah. Well, I have another question about the range of that.
Yeah.
But that's sort of, you know, there are all these programs about the hoarders, and then you come and clean their houses and look at them. But in the minimalist group, there are people who it's so like they can't have anything in their mm-hmm. house. It's like anti-clutter becomes this, oh, like you are panicking right now because there is a thing in that place. And
yeah,
but in that group, it's sort of like they are worshipped for being
mm-hmm.
the most cluttered. So my question, I guess, is in a way of, do you feel that sometimes society, and the same with your BDD, society sort of sometimes reward you for some of the OCD, and that sort of
absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely.
That must add to it, right?
So the weight thing is obvious, right? We say, "Oh wow, you've lost weight, you look amazing," and we never say, "Oh wow, you've gained weight, you look amazing." So obviously, that's easier to explain. Yes, with the OCD, I think there's two answers to this question. One, it's important for me to distinguish between me and it. So I had this wonderful therapist who, like, with whom I was able to work out, like, I am actually a very aesthetic person. I like things to look beautiful. It's why I like to bake. It's why I like to look at, like, it's why I like to color code my bookcase. It's why I like to, like, look at interior design websites. I love things to be pretty. It's why I dress like a doll on stage. Like, I know, and that can be true and sit alongside the fact that I'm a person with OCD, which is, like, was a real relief to know. But they bleed. And so, yes, people are rewarded because and reinforce the negative because, like, even having not met someone, having not had so much my house, right, for example, one thing people will often say, and it's an unfortunate thing, you don't say this to people with OCD, but I'll say I have OCD, and they'll say, oh, you must have such a tidy house. And it's like, A, there are multiple types of OCD, so that's not the case necessarily. B, if I do, that's not necessarily for a good reason. And C, yes, but that's not the point. And also, that's not where my value comes from either, right? And it shouldn't be. So yes, I think it does get, like, you know.
And don't insinuate that you're jealous.
Like, yeah,
oh my God, you're so lucky that you can just keep your house tidy.
Uh-huh. It's like, you're so lucky you can sleep at night, but okay. And it definitely was underscored by, like, reward for being for thinness, reward for a sense of order, or like a seeming glean of, like, good hosting. And like academically, it's definitely rewarded.
Yeah, I was about to ask about the school system and how that, absolutely. When you said you were taking notes and stuff, I thought, good student, which
yeah,
is
exactly
another reward, right? You look yeah. the way you're meant to look,
or like overworking,
capitalism. Definitely.
Yeah, so it's all definitely, yeah, you have to be mindful that, like, it's like, I don't like with like full, not that's the wrong word. I think with all eating disorders, that is a real issue. Is like there's all these tests for validity in terms of and constant underscoring of with positive reinforcement for what is like extremely harmful behavior. So yeah, I definitely think the same is true in this instance.
Do you know where it comes from?
The OCD?
Yeah.
You know, I've read lots on it. And, like, it's fascinating if you look at the stats on people with OCD in terms of, like, how many of them are eldest children. Mm. Really, really high numbers. Like, and whether or not that has that sense, something to do with, like, duty and a sense of being good, or, like, morally culpable or leading. If you look at, it's, like, theoretically, seemingly quite inherited. But the answer is I don't know. I don't think there is a definitive answer. And I stopped caring a long time ago. Because, like, It was definitely the question I and everyone in the group therapy sessions I used to have to do in hospital was asking, like, what's the cause? What's the cause? What's the cause? What's the cause? Which I think eventually I was just like, even if we knew that, we can't like go back and stop it. So at what point is this just a functioning as a distraction from actually doing the work on what is occurring? And I think that's like, speaks to OCD as an illness in terms of it being quite a talk. I mean, what? It's quite a, like a, we're talkers. She says, not having taken a breath in 12 minutes. But like that's why like CBT works so well for, cognitive behavioral therapy works so well for me, because like there isn't an hour long session I can't talk my way out of. Give me a break. Whereas when it's like, but what did you do differently? Then I actually have to. And so I think the same is like, where does it come from? I don't know. Does it matter? I'm not sure. I mean, there's lots of interesting stuff on how our brains do, in fact, like neurologically work differently. But again, that only matters to me insofar as like, I know that medication helps me.
What are you on? What's your medication?
Citalopram, which is not something that I know anything about the value of for other people. I just want to flag that. Not a doctor. Big old clan. Do not know if you should use it. But have been on medication for 8 years. Probably will be for my whole life. Really try not to have any shame about that anymore. Think the only person whose opinion on it I care about is probably my doctor. And it means I'm alive. So pretty happy with it.
I had such a, when I was younger, an arrogance around it where I was like, oh, medication, like just like go to therapy. Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then now
do the work, do the work.
Just do the work. Like, why are you? Yeah. And now I'm on medication and it's great. It's so good.
Right.
Still therapy is still great. But God, it gives you space to, it gives you like a little distance that you need in order to deal with it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, do both, but one facilitates the other. And I mean that in both ways. But like, yeah, good luck pouring all of your crap out on a carpet and sorting it out without a coffee. It's like the same with therapy, right? Like, you have to have some energy in your tank to deal with all the stuff you have to unpack. And I think medication can sometimes give you that. I'm not saying it works or is appropriate for everyone, but count me in the thank God I have it camp.
How, when you said that you had to become good at separating you from it, that sounds like you must have had to actively sort of figure out who you are, what you like, what you are into. Like, I've had to do it. I think most people have had to do it with something. You know, is this my fatness or is it that I am this, or am I an introvert, or am I just scared of going outside? Am I, you know, and I think if you're someone who is introspective and you think a lot about yourself, I think you're pushed to doing that more than other people who don't have to worry about that. So have you had to sit and actively figure out who you are?
I definitely don't know that it was that conscious, but I think that I did intrinsically link my OCD with my personality. When I first got to a doctor's office, I imagine I was saying, I have to a lot, but I need to, like, those were definitely sentences I said a lot. And I've said this before on podcasts, but like, for me, what really helped was there was this really great psychiatric nurse who was doing something with us, and she was talking about how it's a liar. OCD is a liar. And until you can acknowledge that it's lying to you, and until you can, like, then you can't challenge, you can't even begin to challenge the lie. And then that was great for me on many fronts. That it was maybe not true was huge. That it was a separate entity to me was really, really like a weight off my chest. And then I definitely from then on was able to be like, what is that? Like, is that my instinct? Is that a need I have, or is that it? And doesn't make any sense. So I guess less like having to figure out necessarily who I am, but definitely being able to identify it more. Excuse me, I sneezed. Thank you. And being able to identify it from what was actually good for me was helpful.
Are you sick of talking about it? Like I didn't even set out to make, you know, to talk to you about OCD for the whole thing. Are you tired? Are you in the same place where I sometimes go, where I'm like, can we talk about comedy? Can we talk about work? Can we talk about...
I will say that my anxiety, if I have any, while we're talking about this, was like, this isn't exactly a half a minute, Sophie. I also feel a bit like, oh, I could have done with hearing about it. Also, I think it's easier to talk to you because you understand it, and you haven't asked me anything that insulted me yet, and like that really helps.
All I ever want is not directly right? the guest.
I guess I do get a bit like, well, no, I just get more, it's less that I get sick of talking about it, and more that I get anxious or worried that people think that that's all that I define myself as when I don't. In fact, like, in talking about it, I'm trying to be like, that's a thing, and you can get well from it. And but yeah, it's not hilarious, is it?
It doesn't have to be hilarious, but you're also you have an amazing career, and you're very, very good at your job, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with your OCD. That's just who you are and what you're good at.
Thank you. It's weird because I do probably think of them as like connected, in the sense that like the worst thing happened, you know what I mean? Like, everyone went and got jobs after university, and I was like the sad girl who went to hospital, and all that like shame or whatever. It just means like, if people are like, oh, she's trying stand up, how embarrassing. I'm like, please, you weren't talking to me anyway, like, it's fine. So that it was helpful for that. And also, I don't know if you find this with stand up, but like, I think this is probably true of any job that you love, but it's quite a helpful one when you have dark thoughts or dark, because it's just somewhere else for your brain to go. I'm really bad with embarrassment or shame. And so this new valve for release that can go like, oh, but is it funny? Is this unbelievably powerful gift of a job, I think.
I think that's why I initially wanted to ask you if it's sort of how the OCD plays into doing comedy. But then I thought, well, the OCD, like, contextually,
yeah,
it's not like every single comedian has OCD, and it's not like every single person who has OCD is also a comedian. Like, I think everyone, all comedians, can trace back, you know, how certain things in their lives either made them funny or works against them being comedians. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take away from the fact that they are great comedians.
Yeah, it definitely gives and takes. Like, it's good because at the start it gave me like something to talk about, and it probably still does give me something to talk about. It gives me empathy, but it also like makes me never feel like I've had a good gig.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my brain is like, I've learned a lot of behaviors that are like, that could have been better.
Oh, that's interesting, because I feel the same way, but I've always put it down, not about you. Not like, good, I was thinking about you. You've never had a good thing.
You know what the problem with my brain is? My brain went, finally, a truth teller. Like,
but I put it down to being like realistic and good at your job, that you don't just, because there will always be something to do better.
Oh, agreed. Yeah.
In my head, I'm always like, no, it was fine. Like, I'm happy with it. I'm not going to be beating myself up about it. But realistically, I fucked up that line and that line and that line. And that laugh should have been bigger. That should have been an applause break. But, you know, it's fine. Mm-hmm. And then people go, oh, don't be so mean on yourself. You killed. Like, no, that's not killing. I know what killing is. Yeah, that wasn't killing.
Because once 4 years ago, I had the gig of my life and we'll never top it, but we will use that stick to beat ourselves with for the rest of our lives. Yeah, I get you. I hear you. Yeah, I think that's totally normal.
I was hoping it was, and then you said that, and I'm like, oh no. Well, another thing to bring up in therapy, I guess.
It's nice to have new things, isn't it, at this age? Oh, thrilling.
Do you think that there's part of what attracted me to comedy is that suddenly there were people that it was almost like all kind of small talk was just out the window, and you could just immediately start talking about the darker things or the uncomfortable things. And I was so sick of talking to regular people who would say, oh no, after everything I said about my life. Not like it wasn't even that I opened with like deep traumatic trauma. It would just be something negative or something about the world.
I wonder if that's because we're foreigners. Like, there's an antidote to Britishness in the brazen honesty of comedy. Like, and that's not because British people don't care or don't empathize or don't want to, but the culture here is not like, hello, give me your trauma. Which is very much certainly the Irish way. Like, it is like, how are you? Did you hear who died? It's like, is like a casual chat. So I wonder if maybe it's that. But yeah, I think definitely that kind of, I mean, it wears also. Like, I think comics, we can be a little bit like, we can walk around as open wounds a bit too much. And then you know, like, where are my boundaries? Am I talking to the right people? Do they know what to do with that information? You know, so it can be good and bad. But yeah, I think you're probably right.
Are you good at boundaries?
No, I'm working on it.
How? What's the trick?
I think I'm bad at saying no. I will always try to do what I can, even without like assessing whether or not that's a thing I care about or like needs to be done by me or is of value or going to cost me. I think I'm also, don't know if you can tell, Sophie, a real blabbermouth. So I will often say things and then come away and think, ugh, why did you give every single piece of information to that person? You don't even know them, or they don't even care. Or I'm working on it. I think the thing that helps me is reminding myself that stand-up is a job, because like it looks like a party, like it looks like a pub, it feels like a pub, it is a pub. You know, if it really, and it has all those, and then just going like, oh no, actually, like you want to do this forever. So maybe just like, maybe don't tell everyone everything all of the time. Maybe just, you don't have to, maybe just find sex somewhere else, Catherine. Maybe you can do that. Lay out that.
the progression of being, I guess, and not a cis male comic is, your first gig, someone will say, never fuck comedians. And you're like, yeah, nice try. So you can have them all to yourself.
Yeah. Eh?
And then there's like a period of years where you do it. And then you're the one saying to the new people, listen, whatever you do. No, and I know how you look at me. No, trust me on this one. And then you never learn.
So true. It's so true. You got to learn all by yourself. But lesson learned, Sophie. Lesson learned. I'm good. That's cool. Done.
Do you think that, I mean, it wasn't even until you brought up the foreigner thing, which is, of course we are.
Yeah.
What, I mean, this is my shame. I knew nothing about the whole Ireland, England, UK, is that something that you, like the history, this is such a weird question, I think. Is that something you feel as an Irish person, the history between the countries?
Profoundly.
Really? But how does that work? I'm so ignorant to this. I'm so sorry.
So when you're 4 or 5 in Ireland, you start school and you start learning Irish, you start learning to speak Oscuelga, and that is a politicized language because it's one that was made rare by purposeful extinction. And so the first thing you learn is that we had a language and a culture and a culture of literature, and it was essentially almost brought to the brink of extinction by English people who didn't allow us to speak our own language. Then you start to learn history, and the history curriculum in Ireland is predominantly about Ireland's interaction with the UK, which is not reciprocal here. That is not, Ireland does not feature on the British curriculum, apart from there's a brief mention of a potato famine that had nothing to do with us. And so tragic are the numbers of people who died throughout the various British rules in Ireland over so many centuries that it's you can learn the history of Ireland from 1200 to now, and it's one that is new waves of British oppression. And that does not mean that I think nationalism is a legitimate outlook, because I think nationalism is obviously absurd and inherently divisive, nor does it mean that I hate English people. I live here. I have had relationships with English people. I love them. And actually, I feel the lack of understanding from British people and my own nationalism, where it is there, much more starkly now that I live here than I ever did in Ireland. So in Ireland, it was just a truth, but not an important one. But here, because there's an ignorance, I get much more rage filled. I get much more my back gets up a lot, because I'm just how do you not know? How do you not know? So what I'm saying is, not that I personally have this huge focus on it, but that you can't be an Irish person, you can't have come out of the Irish school system and then do a university history degree, which I did, in Ireland, and not be saturated with the history of the two islands.
When does it come up? Because I feel like I'm sometimes quite, so ignorant. I once did a joke in about red hair, which in my world in Denmark, red hair is the best thing you can have. Everyone had a boyfriend who would always say to you but this red hair woman, it was so. I did a joke about red hair, thinking that I was kicking upwards.
Yeah,
but then I got these complaints saying that no, there's a reason why in this country, ginger is a bad thing, and that stems from the Irish thing. And I had that was, ooh, the first time I realized that there was a...
It hadn't occurred to me that ginger was anti-Irish. It's so weird. There's no anti-ginger thing in Ireland, because nor is there a fetishization of it either. But it'd be mocking rain here. You know what I mean? It's like, well, there's so much of it. What are you talking about? You can't, it's just a thing. It's so I...
Just wondering what kind of comments or what kind of...
Oh, what things come up? I guess, obviously currently, contextually, Brexit was a big... It's fascinating, right? Because suddenly I have an awful lot of British people telling me they're getting Irish passports.
Oh.
And simultaneously talking about how Ireland is the blockade on Brexit. And you're we didn't vote for it. It's not our problem. What is not? And then the narrative around a hard border, around the Irish Sea, around the distinctions between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. It's English people calling Ireland Southern Ireland, on a sharp edge, it's famine jokes, and you're haha, a million people. and died. And you're like, or like, so yeah, I think there's loads. I mean, the Brexit negotiations definitely were revealing, I think, of an utter disparity in knowledge, shall we say, on the history of, and indeed the current status of our of the precarious political balance, especially in the north. But again, I'm making this all sound like I care a lot more than I do. I think I only care when I'm like, oh, come on, you're meant to be in the know. And like 16-year-olds in Ireland could tell you this. It's not the... You don't need John Major, you know what I mean?
It's sort of, in my head, I'm just... What you just said just sort of relates to what I was trying to articulate, which is... Well, the question would be if there is still... an actual consequence today, or if the, like, this, I don't know, it sounds so weird when I say it, are the Irish still oppressed, or is the oppression the fact that it's not being acknowledged, or like there hasn't been any reparations? Like, would you consider yourself is it an oppression? Is it a group that...
I don't know that I could speak for my nation. Here's what I'd say. I'd say no, like, in the sense that, like, there are consequences of previous oppression, like, depending on your worldview, like, we should all be speaking Irish, and that's a great shame, or, like British legal culture, in depending on, like, where you're talking about, in which century, may have been more or less patriarchal than Irish was. But, like, I think it's not about, like, being oppressed now, because Ireland has thrived as an independent country. But there are definitely consequences. I mean, you go to Ireland and there's, like, look at the buildings and the architecture, and you'll see, like, there's definitely good and bad left. But I think, like, there's no way to answer your question without acknowledging that, like, the North is still a precarious, like, it's like a hard-earned peace, and it's one that is fresh and one that is, like, delicate, and that cannot be dicked around with, for want of much more technical terms, like it has been. And thankfully, there have been experts in most of these situations to go, sorry, you can't do that, which is why, like, you see Ireland being like, oh yeah, if you come from England, you have to self-isolate. But if you go from Ireland to England, England's like, I assume they floated it a few times to maybe put us on the list. But then I think at some point someone was like, absolutely not, we don't fuck with Ireland. So like, there's good and bad consequences, who knows? Yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just, it's something that we may have learned about it in Denmark, but if we did, I wasn't there that day.
But also, like, we're like, of course our curriculum's dominated by it. Like, we were the little guys, and it was, you know, it was our entire history. We are not the UK's entire history.
Oh, but we also, in Danish school, we learned a lot about, you know, Sweden taking some of our country, yes, and Germany, yes, taking some, but, you know, we learned very little about our participation in the slave trades.
Oh, sure. Yes, of course. Like, absolutely. Like, we were definitely, like, the poor little victims, no matter what the... So, you know, we're all willing to turn an eye to our own flaws, of course, especially in history. Sure.
So I will give you some context as for what will happen now, which is...
Okay.
I feel like when I do this properly, I won't continuously just say the word context, but...
I really like it. Also, the people who are listening will be able to tell, but there's this beautiful eyebrow raise you do every time with context. Yeah.
How can you see that? I have my fringe down.
I'm really looking. Yeah, there it is. But it's great. I just wanted people to know at home that there's like emotion that goes with it.
I'm really into the idea of context. Okay, so I will ask you the final question. Then I will ask you to pluck your stuff. And then I will say goodbye. And then I will ask you an extra 6 fun questions for the Patreons.
Amazing.
That's what's going to happen. But first, before I do that, how are you feeling now? How do you feel about the whole conversation? Do you feel like there's something that you haven't been asked? Something you wish you would have been asked? Are you, what place are you in right now?
Oh, I feel like I talked too much and sounded like a know-it-all and maybe it was a bit boring.
All of that's not true.
Well, you kind of have to say that, don't you? But I also feel like I'm really glad I got to talk to you. It's weird how you are an entity online. and it's quite like, I think it's easy to sometimes forget that you're like a person.
Okay.
Not like to say that I, that sounds as in like, that sounds very, I think you're so present on my feed all the time. And I think I just think that you're like you seem very formidable online. And I think, I don't know, it's nice to see you in a reindeer onesie and be like, I feel like comforted by the fact that we had like a nice warm giggle. I don't know. What am I trying to say? Do you know what I'm saying?
I think so. And I also think a lot of that is pandemic of, oh yeah, people are real people and they're not just on the internet or my neighbors.
You know? Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to say is like, they're not just like a brand or like, they're not just, everyone's also just like, does just wear pajamas in their kitchen and I'm not like failing if I do that sometimes. So really what I was saying about you, I was really talking about myself again. God, what a fucking narcissist.
Okay, you know the whole point of you being on the podcast is talking about yourself and answering questions on things you know. Like this was your whole job. I would have been sad if you had talked less.
I know, but it makes me uncomfortable. And yet I do it so willingly. So really, who am I lying
to? You need to just sit with it.
I'm so fucking sick of sitting with it. How many times can I say fuck? Sorry.
Maybe just relax a bit, you know, just chill. Just have a chill.
I might try just maybe I'll just ignore it.
Have you tried yoga?
No.
So I will ask you the last question that I always ask on this podcast. So I pushed up my glasses even though I'm not wearing them.
Oh, I thought you were doing some sort of third eye thing. And I was like, they just mocked yoga and now they're, oh my God.
No, I pushed up my glasses that I am definitely not wearing. You're in the delivery room and you have just been born. So teeny tiny Catherine Bohart has just been born and she was so happy in the womb. It was all nice and dark and simple and easy. And now she's out and there is lights and there are sounds and there are so many people and she's covered in this gross gunk and what is happening? But you right now, 32, you're holding tiny Catherine and she's looking at you like, excuse me, is this life? Is this what I've been waiting for 9 months? Like, is this just what life is going to be like for the rest of my life? Is this going to be lights and sounds and people? And that is horrible. What is going to happen? And you know what's going to happen. You can't change the future. You can't give yourself advice. None of that. You're just holding yourself as a baby who's asking you, hey, Catherine, you know what's going to happen the next 32 years. What is this? How is it going to be? And you know there will be lights and sounds. You know there will be people. But you also know a fuller context of what it's actually going to be. So what would you say to teeny tiny baby Catherine?
Climb back in. Not allowed to give advice.
No. You can't, because you can't change anything. Everything will happen exactly the way it's already happened. You'll end up exactly in this place. She'll forget it immediately after. But right now she's scared and she just wants to know what's ahead.
I guess I'd say, yep, this is it. It is this traumatic the whole time. But you are resilient. And so you're going to be fine. And the more traumatic it is, the faster you'll become resilient. So don't forget to embrace it. But I'm not allowed to give you any advice, so I wouldn't say that last bit. I wish I could give her advice. Because every urge in me is like, have fun. Try to have some goddamn fun, because you're bad at having fun. Have some fun. But I think I like to think I'd be like, yes, this is it. It's bad, but you're resilient. And also, you fucking love people. And they're mainly it. They're mainly it. So it's not all bad. It's mostly bad. But people are great until they're not. But before then, they're pretty good. So, yeah.
Do you think no, it's perfect.
I will regret later. This I'll be like, you should have thought about this. You should have thought about what you were going to say. You've listened to the podcast. You should have known that it was coming. Why did you not preempt this? I think that's what I'd say. People. You got people.
You still need to be told to have fun.
Yeah. Real.
That's the only way you can actually give advice to yourself as a child, right? Is by giving it now.
Yeah. I think I do. I think I am a real worrier and a real controller. And so I'm so busy worrying and fixing and controlling that I don't like the mess of fun. So yeah.
Know the feels.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing it. Where can people find your stuff? I wanted to ask you about this as well, because you're so proactive in this pandemic world, and you're doing so much stuff on the internet, which I love. I'm always like, yes, do it.
Thank you.
Do it.
Thank you. I thank you for having me. I've had a really nice time. Yeah, please find me. I am busying myself on the internet because I need the money, because I don't like sitting still, and because otherwise I'm just a lady sitting with her feelings all the time, and I can't take that many baths. I can't afford the water bill, Sophie. So
I've never had a better reason for supporting someone's work.
I'm just like, I need the money. I want to talk to people and I need the money. And you can find me on Twitter at Catherine Bohart, on Instagram at Catherine Bohart. And I run a weekly online gig called Gigless. And I try to book balanced, thoughtful, representative acts who I don't think will make anyone feel excluded. And all the money gets split, like every penny gets split evenly between the acts, which is like the main purpose of the gig. And on Monday nights, I do an Insta live for lockdown 2, because I was real anxious because it was my first time living alone as a grown-up. So I just chat to a friend, and you can come to that for free. And the gig is affordable, I like to think. And other than that, hopefully in the real world, you can come to a live gig. And I promise to talk about things other than mental illness. It'll just be like a nice undercurrent when I do stand-up. How about that?
Just an undercurrent of mental illness.
Yeah, just like an ever-present old friend. I think that's everywhere they can.
And the details for the gigs, can we find that on social media?
Yes, on Instagram, on Twitter, but also on my website, catherinebohart.com. Thank you for being better at plugging me than I am at plugging me. I'm just like, please send the money. But that's not a... That's not
PayPal is.
Yeah, exactly. Salt code. Exactly. That's not helpful. Yes, you can come to the gig and I will dance for the change. I promise.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to hear a bit more from Catherine Bohart, I highly recommend that you head to Patreon right now and you sign up to hear Catherine talk a bit more and answer a few more questions. You can also get special behind the scenes recordings and discount codes, and you get my 2 stand-up shows for free. Also, join in order to support the podcast and help contribute to the transcripts, the editing, the equipment, the software, the domains, and just all the hours that go into this. You can find all the information on Mopod, that's mohpod.com/donate. And if you liked this episode and if you felt like it gave you something, something positive, a feeling, something nice, like, share, retweet, give it a 5-star review on iTunes. It actually does matter. Or just tell a friend. And of course, make sure you go and find Catherine Bohard on social media and give her a massive thank you for being a part of this podcast. I'm certainly very grateful. A special thanks to the following Patreon heroes: Amy Melody, Andrea Carbo-Roggan, Andy Walker, Anne-Marie Hepburn, Barry Norton, Beth Payton, Cherry Windsor, Claire Fletcher, Daniel Reifersheed, Danielle Johnson, Deborah Cody Say, Dieter Brønberg Jensen, Emma Chan, Fenella Don Privacy, Osaurus, Aurora Teratops, Galway Cass, Georgia, Harold Van Dyke, Harry Minard, Helen Jerina, Isabel Johnston, Joe C., Catherine Williams, Katie Hatfield, Katrina Pedersen, Kirsten E., Kirsten Davidson, Lindsay Bushniak, M. Dash, Maeve Houlihan, Maury Fraser, Megan Roberts, Paul Swaddle, Pierre Finne, Rachel Furley, Ragdoll, Rianne Rivers, Robert Knowles, Robin Cabot, Ruth Flory, Samantha Kitson, Sarah Allitt, Sarah Plumer, Sheena Machette Cole, Simon James, Victoria Greer, and Victoria Layton, and Zoe Stephenson. And if you want your name shouted out at the end of the episode, please go and join our Patreon and check it out and find out how. I want to say a massive thank you to you for listening. Thank you to Dave Pickering for editing this episode, to Harriet Brain for writing and recording the jingle, and to Justine McNichol for the logo. Speak to you soon. Bye!